This meant that we had to make sure we didn't need to pee during that hour. If we did, we'd have to walk two doors down to the library to use their facilities. The boarders, plus my mother's full-time employment at the photo counter of JCPenney, covered most but not all of the monthly nut. My brother worked at our next-door neighbor's Western Apparel store. I took on a number of odd jobs. We both chipped in. In junior high, I had a job. A con job, really. Distributing the throwaway rag, the Canoga Park Chronicle. First, I was supposed to stick people with the paper. Then I was instructed to knock on their doors and collect the fee. Shock of all shocks, not many people cared to pay $3.10 a month for a paper they neither ordered nor wanted. The few nice folks who did pony up only felt sorry for me. I canvassed every house in the square mile of my territory. I lost track of how many times I heard, "Stop delivering that damn thing! It pisses me off every time I have to pick it up off my driveway and throw it in the garbage." "Okay," I'd say, more desperation in my voice than brightness. "Let's just have you pay the last month as a cancellation fee." "I never ordered it, jackass!" Trying so hard to give people something they clearly didn't want was eroding my confidence and spirit. Every day I wanted to quit, and the amount of time it took to complete my deliveries was cutting into my master plan of achieving a C average at Columbus Junior High School. I decided that I'd only deliver the paper to the nice people who sympathized with my plight. The rest of the papers, I jettisoned into a dumpster near my house. I'd stroll casually up to the receptacle, look around to make sure there were no witnesses, and open the lid and quickly throw my papers inside. Then I'd walk away nonchalantly. No one was any the wiser. Until they were. Apparently, businesses that paid for the dumpster didn't appreciate my disposal habits. They called the newspaper, and I suppose it wasn't too hard for my bosses to find the culprit in the case of the missing papers. My boss called my house and excoriated me. I remember he used the word stealing several times, and then he fired me. I stood in the kitchen with the receiver in my hand for a long time after he hung up. I was racked with shame, and more than that, surprise. I knew my actions were underhanded, but I don't think I fully understood that they constituted thievery. Sneaky Pete. I was the kid who always looked for the shortcut, the scammer, the trickster. I was the mischief maker. If there was a way to shirk responsibility, I'd find it. Somewhere along the way, my family nicknamed me Sneaky Pete. And especially during my teenage years, I lived up to the name. In woodshop class, the teacher asked me what I would like to make for my final. I was feeling estranged from my mother, so I decided to bridge the gap by making her a chessboard tabletop, one of a half a dozen approved projects. Though I was devoid of much talent in the woodworking department, the piece came out pretty well. I bought professionally lathed legs, attached them to the top, and voila! I presented the finished product to her. "Hey, Mom, I made something for you." The look on her face. She was elated. I hadn't seen her so happy since my single-digit years, since my father left. I hadn't been receiving a lot of praise or nurturing, so genuine appreciation and marvel at what she perceived to be my skill and craftsmanship was pure joy, joy all around. One day, I walked into the living room, and she was proudly showing off the table to a friend, running her hand along the legs like a game show hostess displaying the grand prize. "Brian made these," she exclaimed. "So beautifully designed. My son," she said. I was about to interject with a clarification that I'd actually only made the chessboard, but the friend was impressed, which made my mom even more jubilant. I was caught somewhere between smiling and throwing up. I wanted to say, "I didn't make those legs. Look at them. They're perfect." They could only have come from a professional mill. How could she not know that? I told her I made the chess table. I assumed she would understand that that meant I made the table top. But I couldn't bear to correct her. She wasn't happy very often, for the rest of her life, really. And I didn't want this little run to end. So, from that moment on, I just nodded when anyone asked if I made the table. She kept that thing for years, and every time we had a guest, she'd wax on about my craftsmanship. I'd just nod and smile, starting to get comfortable with my lie. Throughout high school, I got sneakier and sneakier. I somehow connived to obtain 2 student ID cards. Both pictured me, but my alter ego was named Bill Johnson. I picked a name I could easily remember. My idea was that if I got into trouble, I could throw the authorities off Brian Cranston's scent by handing them Bill Johnson's ID card. Brian was in 12th grade, Canoga Park High, class of 74. But Bill was class of 75, a junior. I didn't want any confusion. I considered every detail. I belonged to no school clubs or organizations, but on photo day, my best friend Sergio Garcia and I inserted ourselves into a good many group shots. There we are among the knights and ladies, and standing tall with the proud members of the chemistry club. We were also handsome cub reporters on the Hunter's Call, the school newspaper. The other kids actually took part in something. They learned about science or journalism or, well, I don't know what the knights and ladies learned about, but I was there just to pose for a picture. It was a goof, a joke. And all the other kids thought it was funny, but behind the joke was the truth. I was a guy searching, showing up for the wrong things, not showing up for the right things. And in fact, in my senior yearbook, I am missing from the row of students with the last name C. At some point, I drew an arrow to the place where I should have been pictured and wrote in all caps, "Where am I? Rip off! Where am I?" Beast Feeder. I picked up a job a few blocks from my home, preparing the Sunday Los Angeles Times for delivery. Boring. But on the plus side, I got to work with Ruben Valdez. Ruben was an excellent athlete, with a great personality and a smile that made him popular with girls. I, on the other hand, didn't make the baseball team, and I had a crooked smile. I was unremarkable and shy. I liked working alongside a beam of light like Ruben. Maybe some of his light would rub off on me. We arrived at our job site, an industrial garage unit, at 3 a.m., and the unmistakable scent of newsprint hit us before we even rolled up the metal door. We went to work assembling all the sections of the paper that had been dropped off at the door. Then one of us would feed the beast, an ancient paper-folding machine with an assembly line of rollers and a wrapper. The beast made a horrible crunching sound as it bent the thick paper and tied it with string. The guy who wasn't feeding collected the finished products and stacked them for our boss, Leroy Wacko, whose name was actually pronounced with the long A, like the city in Texas, Waco. But of course, we called him Wacko. At dawn, when we finished feeding and stacking, we'd stuff Leroy's car. He'd go off to deliver, and I'd walk home in an exhausted stupor. Leroy was busier than a one-armed man flinging newspapers from a stick-shift VW bug. Actually, that's exactly what he was. The guys at the paper called him the one-armed bandit. He had lost his right arm. I never asked how. He'd slip his left arm through the steering wheel and rest it on the shifter. When he approached a customer's home, he'd slow down, put the car in neutral, and pull his arm free, steering with his knees. He'd grab a paper and then hurl it toward a porch or driveway. He never, ever missed his target. He had the elegance, precision, and timing of a gold-glove shortstop turning a double play. Occasionally, when we were ahead of schedule and the papers were wrapped and ready to go, I would ride shotgun. "Coming up," Leroy would say. That was my cue. Wedged into the passenger seat, I'd prepare to toss a paper out of my window. We'd slow to a crawl. "Now!" Out it went. I did not have a fraction of Leroy's skill. I hit a lot of trees, a lot of gutters. "God damn it, kid," Leroy grumbled. He called both Reuben and me kid. I don't know if he ever knew our names. We'd come to a stop, and I'd run out and put the paper where it belonged. It didn't take long for Leroy to reconsider my role. "Just keep a steady supply of papers for me to grab when I'm ready," he'd say with a sigh. "Just feed the beast." House painter. When the beast feeding finally got to me, my friend Jeff suggested I work for his dad, a house painter who needed help on the weekends. I'd met Jeff in the West Valley Division of the Los Angeles Police Department Explorers, a branch of the Boy Scouts. He was Native American, and his last name was Redman. Well, pronounced Redmond, but he was able to joke about it. He was cool and streetwise, with a strong, mischievous streak. His dad, Jim, was a man of few words. On our first day together, a Saturday, Jim picked me up at 6 a.m., and we rode in silence to an industrial building, a job he had already started. When we began, he tossed a rag to me and said, "Soak that in turpentine and keep it in your back pocket. Anytime you make a mess, clean it up right away. It'll be your best friend." "Okay," I said. Made sense. We finished day one at dusk. I was beat and uncomfortable. By the time Jim picked me up the next morning, I had developed a mysterious rash on my backside, raw and itchy and irritating as hell. On the drive to work, he noticed me scratching my sore left ass cheek. "What's the problem?" I told him I didn't know, but something probably bit me or else I was having some kind of allergic reaction. I glanced his way and I caught a slight smile crossing his lips. We sat there in silence for a while, easy for men to do. But why would he be smiling? Then it dawned on me. He told me to keep the turpentine-soaked rag in my back pocket. It was the turpentine. That bastard did it on purpose. I didn't say anything. I took it as some type of initiation. But I did find another location to stash my turpentine rag. One day, after quitting time, we didn't go straight home. Instead, Jim drove to a far-flung neighborhood. In an alley behind a row of tract houses, he slowed to a stop and got out of the truck. I wondered where he was going, but he didn't say anything. I had become accustomed to his taciturn ways. He peered over a fence and then came back into the truck cab. He handed me a lunch-sized brown paper bag and told me not to open it. "Just take it up onto the bed of the truck. When you're up there, look over the fence, and you'll see a swimming pool. Toss the bag into the pool, and then come down and get back in the truck." The task seemed simple enough, and I knew why he asked me to do it instead of doing it himself. The years of physical labor had beaten him up pretty badly. He had limited mobility in his arms. I began to ask what was in the bag. "Just go on," he said. And I did as my boss instructed. Hopped into the back of the truck and peered over the tall fence that separated the homeowner's property from the alley. I saw that it was an easy 15 feet to the pool's edge, so the throw had to be at least that. Better to be long than to have it land on the deck or a chair. I flashed back to how disappointed one-arm Leroy was after I had botched it with the newspapers. I couldn't mess this up. I weighed the bag with my hand and determined that it was heavy enough to toss underhand, like a horseshoe. I gauged the distance several times, thinking it through, and finally Jim got impatient. "What the hell are you doing up there? Throw the goddamn bag." I took a deep breath, and I tossed it high into the air. It felt good. It looked good. It was good. Right into the middle of the pool. Swoosh! Yes! I quietly pumped my fist and scampered down into the truck's cab. As Jim drove off, I waited for an explanation. When that wasn't forthcoming, I asked. He nodded and smiled. "Inside the bag was dried India ink," he said. "When the paper got saturated and fell apart, the powder would expand and bloom and spread throughout the pool, finally settling on the plaster siding and bottom and permanently staining it. The owners would have to drain the pool and sandblast the entire surface to remove it. That's why he told me not to open the bag. It would have stained my hands." He explained that he painted that house nearly a year ago. He tried again and again to get them to pay, but no dice. This was his way of closing the account. On another occasion, Jim picked me up and we went to a small market that opened early. He grabbed a couple of sodas, a few packs of cigarettes, the man could smoke, and six whole mackerels. An odd selection of groceries, but as I had come to know Jim, not that odd. I didn't even bother to ask. We drove to an unoccupied two-story modern in the Mount Olympus area off Laurel Canyon in the Hollywood Hills. We parked in the street in front of the house, and Jim told me to grab the 10-foot ladder. He retrieved the hidden key from the planter near the back door and marched upstairs. I instinctively knew to follow. He pointed to a spot in the middle of the upstairs hall. I opened the ladder on exactly that spot. He told me to climb up and open the air conditioning's intake grill. I did. The filter plopped out of its resting place, and I handed it to him. As I steadied myself about 8 feet off the ground, I heard crinkling. I looked down and saw Jim removing the wax paper from the mackerel. He calmly instructed me to throw the first one inside the AC ducting in one direction as far as I could. I threw it, and we heard it slide 15 or maybe 20 feet. He handed me another cold dead fish, this time telling me to send it down a different duct. I threw three fish in three directions. I replaced the filter and reaffixed the intake grill's clasp. We methodically moved to the downstairs intake and repeated the steps. Three fish, three directions. We returned to the truck and drove for a while in silence. When I couldn't stand it anymore, I asked what it had all been about. "No other fish stinks like mackerel when it rots," he said. "They'd only expunge the smell by replacing all the air conditioning ducts and compressors, the whole system." It was another non-payment situation. I asked if he ever tried small claims court. He smiled, whiter than I had ever seen him smile. "We just did." Explorer. My dad liked that the name Kim Edward Cranston sounded like King Edward Cranston. But when my mother suggested that they just name him King, Dad apparently felt that it would be too hard for my brother to live up to that name, and it might confuse people. They might think it was our dog. "Here, King." So Kim it was, and Kim it remained for about a dozen years. Kim always felt he got short shrift in the name department. Kim was a girl's name, he'd say. Edward, his middle name, was slightly better, but I think he hated his options there, too. Ed, Eddie, Edward, blah. In high school, he decided on Ed, the least unattractive of the bunch. Ed joined the LAPD Explorers, a training ground for future police officers, after a career day at Canoga Park High. In those days, every high school, especially ones like ours in lower middle-class areas, would host visits from service providers to get kids started thinking about their lives after 12th grade. I'm not sure exactly what drew Ed to the program, but I knew what drew me. The first year my brother was in the Explorers, he took a trip to Hawaii. The following year, he went to Japan. I was marking time at odd jobs while my brother sent postcards of white sand beaches and Torrey Gates. I stared a long time at those images, steeped in envy. I joined the minute I reached the minimum age of 16. I had no designs on a career as a cop. I just wanted to travel the world. But in order to join the Explorers, you had to go to the LAPD Academy for 8 Saturdays in a row to study police work. Explorers were asked to man parade routes, help with minor traffic control, issue bicycle licenses, and participate in searches for evidence at crime scenes, among other duties. Our West Valley division was the cream of the crop. The big reason was Sergeant Roy Van Wicklin. Van to everyone except new recruits. You had to earn the right to call him Van. He had been a paratrooper in the Army in World War II, and he brought a soldier's discipline to the Explorers. He was squared away, and he was tough, but only because he cared so much. He arranged for his division's newbies to go through a hell weekend prior to the start of the regular academy with the rest of the division's recruits. We studied police procedures and codes, drill formations. We trained like animals. Eat, train, sleep, repeat. And the older recruits made it extra hellish on us. The consolation was knowing the shit you were taking, you'd get to give back to next year's new crop. Sergeant Van Wicklin set up a special trip to the morgue for us every year. Special, my ass. So many guys came up with lame reasons why they couldn't make the trip. Homework overload. My grandma needs me to walk her across the street. Explosive diarrhea. Those of us without the brains or the balls to make an excuse took the bus over together. I looked around and saw all the guys smiling tightly. Every one of us felt deep dread, though none of us showed it. Wouldn't be manly. The smell of formaldehyde, like pickle juice and aftershave, made my eyes water. We walked by a long row of bodies draped in white sheets. They seemed like zombie spectators settled in along a parade route to watch terrified teenagers shuffle past. I caught sight of a man's bluish foot sticking out from beneath a sheet. Looking around, I realized that all the bodies had one foot uncovered, toe tag dangling, a way for the technicians to quickly locate the corpse they were looking for. Whatever these people had achieved in life, whatever they had seen or suffered, was reduced to a toe tag. That was the inevitable fact. In another room, two men wearing rubberized jumpsuits casually chatted as they worked. Music played from a tinny transistor radio. They barely registered our presence. One was tending a new arrival, a body in full rigor mortis, natural muscle stiffness that occurs shortly after death. We saw the technician snap the body's extremities. We'd learned this part of the process was called breaking rigor. They released the muscles, preparing the body for the next step. No explanation could change how savage it seemed. It was hard to accept that bodies didn't feel anymore. The other man was washing a female body with a sponge and soapy water. I was 16. The only thing I wanted in life was to see a naked woman. To my great misfortune, this was my first. Well, outside of Playboy magazine and accidentally seeing my grandmother stepping out of the shower. Whoever she was, mid-20s, pretty, I wondered what her name was, how she died, whether her family was overcome with grief. A shuddering, overwhelming compassion moved through me. Blam! One of my fellow explorers hit the ground. He fainted, out cold. People rushed to his aid. He'd be all right. The technicians shared a smile. A doctor was describing the protocol at the morgue, but his voice became background noise, like the teacher's drone in a Charlie Brown cartoon. It wasn't until we were almost out of the room that I noticed the song that had been playing on the transistor radio. The Everly Brothers hit, "Wake Up, Little Susie." I'd never hear that song the same way again. If breaking rigor and body washing was the warm-up act, then an autopsy was the main event. We watched a doctor cut a clean line through a man's chest with an electric saw. At another table, a physician peeled back a woman's scalp. Body cavities were opened. Fluids escaped. Organs were gently removed for study. Down went a couple more of my friends. They were carried from the room. Two others left so they wouldn't have to be carted out. I focused on my breathing. My great chicken shit epiphany crossed my mind, but I chose mouth breathing in the end. If I breathed through my nose, the formaldehyde would nauseate me, and I wasn't going to go down like my fallen comrades. At some point, I was able to get beyond my physical responses and focus on the mystery at hand, the essential mystery. An autopsy is ordered only when the cause of death is not absolutely certain. There were discoveries to be made. What happened? Bodies were complex riddles to be solved. Once the doctors had collected all the evidence, they put the body back in the condition they found it, more or less. They poured all the fluids and plopped the organs into the cavity and sewed it up. I saw how professional these people were, and how serious a duty it was to attend to the dead. And yet this was their job, and they needed to desensitize themselves, to be slightly workaday about what they might have once found gruesome, which, of course, was the point in the visit to the morgue. If I took the law enforcement path, I would have to learn to shut down and not let blood and guts and death affect me. But did I want to be desensitized? At that moment, what I wanted or did not want in the long haul was irrelevant. The whole reason I had joined the Explorers program in the first place was so I could see the world. And sure enough, when summertime rolled around, I got to go on a month-long trip to Europe. The entire cost, including airfare, food, and travel, was something like $600. That was a fortune to me then, but the idea of seeing the greater world beyond Canoga Park and the confines of my mother's house was all the motivation I needed. I socked away every dime I could. Police departments in Germany, Austria, Switzerland, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands hosted our group, 20 teenage boys accompanied by a few policeman chaperones. We slept in military barracks or police auxiliary halls. You put your sleeping bag on a cot, and you were home. My first trip abroad, my first time being around people who spoke different languages. They sounded almost moon-like to me. But we didn't have much time to fraternize. Every detail of our days was accounted for. We were guests at lunches and functions and took tours of police facilities, even Interpol. In the evenings, we were unshackled from the itinerary. Each night, we got a lecture. Be back at 2300 hours. Be careful. Don't do anything stupid. Don't go to bars. We went straight for the bars. One night in Austria, I paired off with two guys a little older than me, both more aggressive and confident. They were resolute. They were dogged. They were on a mission. Their virgin years were about to be over. It was time. It was like they had some teenage boy's version of sonar. They made a beeline for an old-world house close to the center of Salzburg. A red light gleamed from the impressive wall sconce. This was the beacon. This was the promised land. I stood in the foyer as the two boys haggled with hand gestures and broken English and agreed on a price. Meanwhile, I made the lame excuse that I forgot to bring money and gave the universal signal for empty pockets. My buddies went upstairs with their chosen companions, and I shrugged and took a seat and stared at my shoes. I think this had been my plan all along. I hadn't had the courage to make that night the night. My friends had boldly met their agenda, no hesitation. And there I sat, glum, berating myself, then giving myself a pep talk. Those guys were braver than me, but I bet neither of them had ever beheaded a chicken. That brought me a shred of solace. When I looked up, a woman in a minuscule blue dress was standing over me, hands on hips. She waved me to come with her. I fished out the few bills I had to show her. I don't have enough. She took the money and grabbed my hand. In the room, she indicated I should take off my clothes. This was happening. I undressed slowly. She handed me a sealed condom. I struggled to open it for a bit too long, and she snatched it back, opening the package and putting it on for me. I was already erect, more nervousness than excitement. She lifted her dress. She wore no panties. What's the point? She lay down on the twin bed and brought me down on top of her and pulled me into her. I saw her breasts. I've got to touch her breasts. I went for it. Soft and whap! She slapped my hand hard, clearly indicating you don't have enough money for that. Just get it over with. And soon it was done. There'd been no fireworks, no tenderness, no talking. We never exchanged names. I had no idea what I was doing. It was just this stranger and me, at this particular moment in time, as uncomplicated as it could be. She wasn't expecting anything from me. She wasn't disappointed. She felt nothing. For her, it had been an utterly forgettable moment. But it was a moment I'd never forget, though I admit I couldn't conjure her face under the threat of death. I got up and got dressed. She got herself together and she was gone. She left the door open behind her. It turned out nearly half the guys in our group went to whorehouses that night, including my brother. We lost our virginity on the same night, an odd coincidence that we never bring up. From that point on, it was the hooker tour. Most of the kids' parents had given them money. Enjoy your trip. In Paris, Brussels, Amsterdam, whenever we were allowed any free time, it was the same patter. What's that? The Louvre? That's nice. Why don't we get going so we can experience some interactions with the locals and help circulate money to the people? Help the economy by supporting small business. Back home, I discovered that the Explorers wasn't just about foreign relations. I discovered I had a real aptitude for police work. As I neared the end of high school, I realized that's how you forged a career. You alighted on something you were good at, and then you bored into it. I applied myself to the Explorers and excelled in physical and scholastic achievement. Running, obstacle course, sit-ups, push-ups, relay course, and marching drills. I learned that a 211 was a robbery and a 459 was a murder. Code 1 was get there when you can. Code 2 meant get there quickly, lights. Code 3 was get there immediately, lights and siren. Code 7 was grabbing a bite to eat. A 10-100 meant you were on a bathroom break. A bit of police argo the film business borrowed. It's part of the lexicon on set. There were codes for all kinds of things. I memorized every last one, along with the proper procedure on securing evidence, when to approach a crime scene, crowd control. I graduated first in my Explorers class, number one out of 111 kids from all over the city, number one. Had I ever been number one at anything? The die was cast. I had learned to shut down my feelings and do the job. I say I was first. I was first with an asterisk. In the final testing at the police academy, I aced the scholastic stuff. And then came the physical component. I breezed through the obstacle course and scored 100, the maximum, in jumping jacks and sit-ups. All I had to do was polish off the push-ups. Every explorer was given a buddy to do the counting to assure accuracy. My buddy was another West Valley recruit named Vince Saratella. Vince was a good guy. He was a friend. After I counted out his 60 or so push-ups, it was my turn to knock off 100 and get a perfect score. I had done 100 push-ups a few times before in training. It wasn't easy, but it was doable, and I was confident going in. I was in peak shape. I was 16 years old, determined to finally achieve something. And then it happened. At about push-up 78, I was laboring and fatigued, but still pretty strong. When I hit 80, Vince called out, 90. What? I was initially confused, thinking that Vince made a mistake, but after a few more push-ups, I realized what he was doing. 92, 93. He was cheating for me. Only a handful of the 111 recruits accomplished 100 push-ups, so 90 was noteworthy. The instructors and other explorers rushed over to cheer me on. I could feel the crowd thickening around me. The group began to count down in unison. I ground out the last few, my whole body burning, my mind roiling about what I should do next. Should I continue and finish it the right way? Or should I just go along and pretend I'd really done the full count? I was still undecided when Vince cried out, 100! My classmates surrounded me and cheered. Vince clapped me on the back. I was a hero, and I was glad not to have to do 10 more push-ups. At the same time, I thought I could have done 10 more. I was exhausted, but not completely spent. I might have done something great. Now I'd never know. I quickly let myself forget Vince, and I got lost in the moment. But as I was getting congratulatory punches on the shoulder, deep down I knew I hadn't entirely earned it. Security guard. I was only 19, and the LAPD's minimum age requirement was 21. Plus, the department's pay scale was better if you had a degree. So I enrolled at Valley Junior College as an Administration of Justice major, a fancy name for police science. On the side, I got a job as a protect-all security guard. I worked in a gated community called Bell Canyon, an exclusive area in the ritzier section of the San Fernando Valley. I waved to residents as they passed by the automatic entry gate and checked in guests and delivery people. I worked the night shift, so there were very few guests and almost no deliveries. In essence, my job was to sit in a roomy, climate-controlled guard booth and get paid to do my homework and sip coffee. I had a pocket notebook with the admonition of rights printed on the front cover. On the back, I scribbled a rating system for my security jobs. 1X was bad, one time only. 4Xs meant a great place to work. I gave Bell Canyon 3Xs. And I did my job well, so well, in fact, that I got a visit from my fully uniformed and armed supervisor. He said he was pleased that I was always at my post and never called in sick. He had zero complaints against me, and he was impressed that I volunteered to work nights, and that I did so without grousing. He wanted to reward me. How did I feel about a promotion? "What about moving out of this dreary place?" he said, waving his hand dismissively at my booth. "How would you like to see some real action, real criminals? The cops are called in almost every night, and," he gave a slight pause for emphasis, "you get to carry a gun." He smiled at me, excited. I smiled back, uneasy. I looked around. I kind of like it here. I do my homework. I listen to Dodger games on the radio. No one bothers me. I didn't want to leave a good thing, but I didn't want to insult my boss. "Does the promotion come with a raise?" I asked. It did. 25 cents an hour. I calculated. That would bring me to a grand total of $4.10 an hour. The extra quarter would have been nice, but I didn't want to carry a gun. And I was incidentally surprised that assuming the immense responsibility of carrying a weapon only earned you 25 cents more. I politely declined, feigning disappointment at the amount of the raise. "Oh, well, I suppose there are a couple other posts I can offer you," he said, taken aback by my crippling lack of ambition. He assigned me to an event at the Century Plaza Hotel on Avenue of the Stars. I was stationed at the back entrance. All the action was in front. The back was much quieter, more intimate. An occasional limo rolled up and outspilled a publicity-shy celebrity. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. And then, suddenly, Alfred Hitchcock. I recognized his portly silhouette immediately. Security personnel whisked Mr. Hitchcock through the back entrance, and the limo doors were taken care of by the driver and the valet. I wasn't sure what my job was even supposed to be, but hell, it was Alfred Hitchcock. I resolved to politely greet him when he left. An hour after he arrived, people around the back entrance started buzzing, and I sensed that someone was making an exit. Mr. Hitchcock emerged and made his way to the waiting car, and I rushed ahead of him so I could open his door. When I got close, I softly asked, "Did you enjoy your evening, Mr. Hitchcock?" I waited for him to bestow upon me some bit of sage wisdom I'd always cherish. Lunging for the limo, he turned slightly toward me and said, "Ah!" He waved his arms chaotically as if to shoo away a fly. He dove into the back seat. I stood there stupidly for a while, and then I went back to my post. That was my first brush with a Hollywood legend. Since I was going to be a policeman, I was pretty sure it was going to be my last. My other reward for being such a great booth guard was a posting in a grocery store called Hughes Market on Highland and Franklin, a transient corner in Hollywood that was rife with crime. I gave Hughes a quadruple X rating in my notebook. My job was to man the two-way mirrors strategically placed high above the store to catch shoplifters. My mother had always had light fingers. Whenever we'd go into the produce section of a supermarket, she would always help herself to a piece of bulk candy. She loved those individually wrapped chocolate-covered caramels. Or she'd casually snap off a sprig from a bunch of grapes, popping them into her mouth as she shopped. My mom taught us that it was okay to sample, that the market factors samples into overall cost. When I was a kid, I would always take a caramel, my brother too, because it wasn't stealing, it was sampling. We never took big items, and never a lot. One was acceptable, three was not. But if, for example, we spotted a bag of Toll House chocolate chips that had already been opened, we'd help ourselves to fistfuls. They couldn't sell the bag now anyhow. I became so accustomed to the candy samples that whenever I walked into a grocery store, I'd crave something sweet. That Pavlovian response went on for years. I still vividly remember looking up at those mirrors in stores and wondering if anyone was behind them. Now I finally learned the answer, and the answer was me. My dark airy in an attic high above Hughes had an L-shaped catwalk. The ceilings were low, so I had to crouch around the catwalk, but the view was expansive. The mirrors protruded so I could even observe the meat counter beneath me. Little stools were set up, and I'd sit, and I'd wait, and watch. I was starting to figure people out, starting to learn how to read them and understand motivation. I was good at spotting thieves long before they stole. I was never wrong. It wasn't that I possessed some preternatural powers of perception. Once you know what to look for, thieves are pretty conspicuous. People who shop are busy. They're scanning their lists and examining labels, doubling back for that item they forgot. People who steal look around and down aisles furtively. Shoppers move quickly. Thieves have a slower pace. They're trying to be careful. I learned to detect the telltale signs. The most telling of tells was when people looked up to the two-way mirror. I wonder if anyone is there. And I was sitting there in the dark whispering, yes, I'm here. People stole constantly. They would take anything, light bulbs, coffee filters, a whole pineapple. A guy stood in the pet supply aisle and pocketed 4 or 5 leashes, dog leashes. They're going to risk getting arrested for dog leashes? By law, a thief had to be outside the store to be caught. If you confronted a guy inside the store, he could point to the leash or cold cuts in his pocket and say, I didn't grab a basket, so I just put it here for the moment while I was looking for something else. Oh, I put salami in my pocket all the time. I had a little microphone at my station behind the mirrors, and when I spotted a thief, I had to communicate to the manager. We had a code. At the precise moment the thief was crossing the threshold of the store, I spoke into my microphone, and my voice blared out through the intercom. Fred, the coffee is on in front, or the coffee is on in back, Fred. The front or back told Fred where to look for the culprit, front door or back door. The manager then rushed to the relevant door and detained the shoplifter outside the store. I made my way down and said, I witnessed you stealing such and such, and then walked back to the manager's office and waited for the cops to show up. It was ridiculously easy. Per 6-hour shift, I could catch up to 10 people. Sometimes I'd have more than one thief in the store at the same time, and I'd have to decide which one I was going to follow. You have packages of soup mix in your jacket. No, I don't. Just show us you don't have them, sir. And the guy would say, all right, all right. He'd open up his jacket, and what do you know? Soup galore. There were no big-ticket items at the store, so it was all petty stuff. But you had to detain them and call the police, because otherwise they would come back night after night. Once you got caught, you were in the system. If we caught you again, there was a cumulative effect, and that meant an arrest and potentially jail time. Hughes Market carried huge roasts wrapped in cellophane. They could run up to 1.5 feet long. One time I saw this couple in their late teens, grungy, probably runaways, loitering in the meat section. The guy was doing that telltale glance over the shoulder while the girl shoved a giant slab of meat down her pants, down the length of her thigh, and headed toward the back door. The roast was so long she couldn't bend her knee, so she was limping, dripping a trail of bloody roast juice in her wake. My cue? Fred, the coffee is on and back. The manager detained them outside, and I went down and confronted her. She got this sheepish look on her face and glanced around as if maybe she were thinking about running, and then let out a sigh of concession and pulled the roast out of her pants. I did the paperwork and waited for the police to show. I was doing my job, and yet I couldn't help feeling sorry for these two. They had to be hungry. Universal Life Minister. Catalina Island is 26 miles off the coast of Long Beach. We always knew the exact distance because the hit 1950s song, 26 Miles by the Four Preps, still came on the radio every now and then. 26 miles across the sea, Santa Catalina is awaiting for me. Santa Catalina, the island of romance, 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 romance. They said it 4 times for a reason. While attending junior college during summer breaks, my brother and I got jobs on Catalina. He drove a taxi, and I landed at a company called Island Baggage, which did big business in the days before some magician invented wheeling luggage. Once the boats docked on the island, Island Baggage would offer to cart the bags as the vacationers walked off their sea legs with a leisurely half-mile stroll into town. 35 cents a bag, a different color tag for each hotel. I loaded up all the bags on Cushman golf carts and then distributed them to the various hotels. It was a summer fantasy come to life, being outdoors and scooting around the island all day in the company uniform, shorts and flip-flops, shirt optional. Schlepping luggage may not sound like the height of romance, but Island Baggage jobs were coveted because we had first crack at the pretty girls as they filed off the boats in their summer dresses and short shorts. Let me take that bag for you. No charge. Want me to show you around? You live here? Yes, my brother and I are here on the island for the summer. Do you have plans for tonight? I had come out of my shell a little, and the freewheeling atmosphere of the island in the 70s made it easy to be with someone new weekly. Girls on vacation were so different from girls at home during the school year. Don't you want to get to know her first? Sure. But the weather is warm, there's an ocean breeze, and she's wearing a bikini. What else do I need to know? I fell in and out of love several times over the course of a summer. Getting a job on Catalina was no problem. The hard part was finding a place to stay. Enter Reverend Bob. During our second summer there, Bob invited my brother and me to rent a room in his condo for $1 a day. He had a nice place, and the price could not be beat. Bob Burton was a 40-year-old guy with an island tan and a toothy smile. He organized and ran the Miss Santa Catalina Beauty Contest, mostly as a way to attract more lovely young women to Avalon, the only incorporated city on the island. The pageants made him a bit of a polarizing figure, but my brother and I thought he was great. He didn't drink or do drugs. He was just a harmless lady lover. Bob was called Reverend because he was an ordained minister with the Universal Life Church. He wasn't religious, but he had fashioned himself into the go-to guy for anyone in Southern California who wanted a non-traditional wedding. He made God a good time. He came to me one day and told me he had made a mistake. He booked 2 weddings, same day, same time. One was there on the island, one was in the valley. "You need to marry these people," he said. "What, me? Have you forgotten who you're talking to?" He fleshed out some of the details, but I was still lost. I couldn't possibly officiate a marriage. Don't you have to have a license or something? Bob said, "I'll ordain you and you can marry them." "As in legally married? No, Bob, I really can't do this." "You're theatrical, you can do it, and it pays $175 for 2 hours' work." Cash has a way of creating bravado. $175 was more than I made in a week. Despite my apprehension, despite my insecurities, I was in. Bob slipped an official document into his IBM Selectric, typed in my details, and whoosh, out it came, my application for registration as a minister in the Universal Life Church. Bob had me sign it and explained that it went to the Secretary of State of California and it would get a rubber stamp approval. By the time you send in the marriage certificate, you'll be registered. Good to go. He handed me a book. "Here's Khalil Gibran. People like this passage, 'For the oak tree and the cypress grow not in each other's shadow,' and so on and so forth. Here is the marriage certificate. Fill out groom's name, bride's name. Fill out the location, witness one, witness two. Fill it all out, and we'll send it into the Secretary of State." He handed me the address of the wedding and his car keys. "Have fun." I got on the morning boat to the mainland, hopped in Bob's VW van he had parked at the terminal, and off I went. I arrived at the address Bob had jotted down for me. Could this be right? I was at the Van Nuys Airport, a busy regional airstrip for private planes. I wandered around the airport dressed in a Hawaiian shirt. I thought I should dress up for the wedding. Shorts and flip-flops. It was midsummer, so I had a sunburn. I called it a tan. And my hair was shoulder length and strawberry blonde. I spotted a couple that looked dressed for the occasion. "Hey, are you guys getting married?" They nodded, confused. I'm the minister." They looked me up and down. The bridal party appeared to be having second thoughts. I assured them that they were in good hands. "It's going to be a memorable day. This is your day. I'm going to take good care of you." I was trying to convince myself more than I was trying to assuage their concerns. "Where are we going to do this?" The groom smiled and looked up. "We're getting married in the sky, bro." We boarded a 6-passenger plane. I knew I needed to take control. I started getting assertive, suggesting the best seat assignments. "I'll sit up front with the pilot. Then the bride and groom, maid of honor and best man in the last row. All set?" I asked where we were headed. The groom told me that we were going to fly around and then they wanted to start the ceremony once we got a clear view of the Hollywood sign. We took off, and before long we were doing loops over the sign. We could start any time. My cue. I took a deep breath, twisted around in my seat, and began to yell so that I could be heard over the twin-engine props. "Stand together, yet not too near together, for the oak and the cypress grow not in each other's shadow." The bride and groom were holding hands, looking at me with moist-eyed sincerity. I was a 19-year-old kid, and they were looking at me as if I were the Pope. I wanted to honor the faith they had bestowed in me. I wanted to honor the solemnity of their commitment and make the performance believable. I wanted to do a good job. I started to improvise. "Communicate!" I screamed over the hum of the engine. "It's extremely important! I can see you love each other! Cherish that love! When times are hard, that love is your bedrock! In sickness and in health, richer or poorer!" I could see the best man and the maid of honor leaning forward, straining to hear. "Repeat after me! With this ring I thee wed!" The yelling didn't seem to diminish the power of the moment. They were nodding and crying. As I progressed, my confidence grew. By the end of the short ceremony, I felt like a reverend. I yelled, "By the power vested in me by the state of California and the Universal Life Church, I now pronounce you husband and wife." I paused, momentarily forgetting what came next. Oh, right. "Kiss her, bro!" He did. I turned around in my seat, facing front again, and exhaled. The pilot gave me an approving nod. I performed several more marriages through the years. Most of my couples were overbookings from Bob, but I married some friends and relatives, too. I married my cousin and my uncle. Not to each other. It was fun, not weird. Some people didn't care for the pomp and circumstance of a formal wedding. Some people wanted a party rather than a church ceremony. I did a cowboy-themed wedding. I married a couple knee-deep in the water off Catalina, getting pushed around by the currents, trying to keep my footing as I soliloquized. I married a couple as an Elvis impersonator. Years later, when my brother agreed to marry a dear family friend from Britain, Julia, so she could stay in the country legally, I presided over their union wearing a bunny rabbit costume left over from Halloween. I was the Reverend Bucky O'Hare. I'd say, "For the oak tree and the cypress grow not in each other's shadow." Khalil Gibran. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. Corinthians. And if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with. Stephen Stills. When I married a couple of friends, Sandy and Stephen, I did my whole oak tree and cypress thing, and then I said, "This love radiates through them so clearly and strongly because you only get married once." I paused. They looked at each other and then back at me. Everyone knew they had both been married before. I continued, "You only get married once in a while." Wild laughter from my congregation. I married a Korean couple. They stood before me with bowed heads and grave expressions. They were petrified. They weren't expecting the fun, secular service I had in store, so I had to adjust to suit their seriousness. The Universal Life Church would marry anyone, gay, only symbolically back then, straight, young, old, conservative, liberal, it didn't matter. It was ahead of its time, progressive and inclusive, and all without a blood test, so I could have married siblings and wouldn't have known the difference. I occasionally wonder if some of the couples I married are still together and it suddenly dawns on them. Holy shit. Honey, I think Walter White married us. Student. Not having any experience or guidance, I chose nearly all my classes within my major my first year in junior college, criminalistics and police systems and practices and such. I did very well. I was sailing right along. So I was surprised when my counselor looked down at my transcript, shaking his head, and told me, "I need electives." I was planning to transfer my credits to a 4-year university the following year, and I thought I had to be completely nose to the grindstone, all criminal procedure all the time. My counselor told me no. In fact, admission offices want to see a well-rounded curriculum. All right, I gazed up to the large board he pointed at. Elective courses, listed alphabetically, abacus for beginners, archery, acting. Wait, I thought of my traumatizing turn as Professor Flipnoodle inside. But it was just an elective, and it could be a good time. I signed up for two classes, Intro to Acting and Stagecraft. The first day of class was a typical September day for the San Fernando Valley. Hot. The small classroom was crowded with kids and painted entirely in flat black. I felt like the walls themselves were a heat source. I learned later the black walls were purposefully neutral. The artistry of the work would supply the color. I looked around. Girls outnumbered boys, maybe 8-1. I didn't mind that. The next thing I noticed was that the girls in acting class were much better looking than those in the police science courses. I didn't mind that at all. The teacher handed out two-person scenes for us to perform. You two do this one, you two take this. I happened to be standing next to a cute brown-haired girl. By virtue of proximity, we'd be acting partners. I smiled nervously at her. Nothing. I cast my eyes down to the paper. I turned my attention to the scene. The opening description read, "A couple is making out on a park bench." I glanced up at the girl, then quickly back to the paper. Son of a bitch, she was really pretty. I read the first line again, just to make sure I read it correctly. A couple is making out on a park bench. I barely remember what the scene was about, and I have no clue what play it was from. I only recall that the boy was to break from the embrace and try to explain to the girl why they should start to see other people. I knew with absolute certainty that if the boy in the scene were somehow able to see the girl who was playing his girlfriend, he would never, ever break up with her. As I reviewed the scene, I kept darting glances at my acting partner. She was busy chatting with a friend and hadn't yet looked at the text. I worried that when she discovered our shared mission, she would be dismayed that I was her leading man. She finally got around to focusing on the script, and she did the same thing I did after reading the opening sentence, looked up. I pretended to be gazing in the other direction as she assessed me. I glanced back and gave her a casual smile. No toothy grin, that would be too much. To my surprise, she didn't grimace or frown or show any sign of displeasure. She just cocked her head slightly to one side and pursed her lips. I guess you'd call it a pondering look. Technically, it was a neutral gesture, but I found it so sexy. I took her noncommittal glance as a major victory. Was I supposed to really kiss her? Really? I went to the teacher and whispered, "It says that the couple is making out. Should we really, make out or just pretend to do it?" A valid question, I thought. The teacher didn't think so and dismissed me. "You're not in high school anymore." Message received. I had to go for it. I was emboldened by the teacher's answer. My heart quickened as I watched an hour of other student scenes. At last, we were called upon to perform. The stage was set, just a bench. The rest was up to us to imagine. We sat down, and I dropped my script to the floor. I'd pick it up when I needed it. "I hope she can handle what I'm about to do. Ready or not, here I come." I started to turn toward her, but she beat me to the punch. She kissed me wildly. Her hands roamed all over my neck and my chest and my legs. She thrust her body into mine, moaning with pleasure. I was delirious. I surrendered to our shared lust. Rubbing, tapping, kissing. Wait, what? Tapping? Yes, my upstage thigh was definitely being tapped. The girl was rubbing my body with one hand and tapping me with the other. But why? Was she performing some kind of dexterity test, like patting her head and rubbing circles on her stomach at the same time? Whatever she was doing, she was amazingly adroit at it, a pro. And then it occurred to me. The scene. We have to do the scene. She was telling me, tapping me, as subtly as she could, that it was up to me to start the dialogue. My character was supposed to pull away, not hers. I finally pushed away from her, took a gulp of air, and said, "Nothing." I forgot my line. I lunged for the papers on the floor and desperately looked for the opening line, but I was looking at page 2. Before the kiss, I easily memorized my first line, "Beth, we need to talk about us," and cleverly flipped to page 2, where I was to follow up with a long explanation. Only I didn't count on having those first few words completely vanish from my brain because of all the kissing and rubbing and tapping. I recovered quickly. The scene started to take off. Before I knew it, it was over. Strange how time seems to speed up. The teacher gave us some notes. I heard nothing.